Hello and welcome to Arcane Connection. Today, in episode 22, Tom and I are going to be discussing how to set up your first Ars Magica game and Ars Magica adventures generally.
Yes.
First of all, though, it's Easter at the moment, so happy Easter. It's Easter Saturday. Yep. Yesterday, we recorded on Good Friday.
Yeah.
It made me think, have you ever come across Eamon Duffy's book, The Stripping of the Altars?
I've not read that, no.
No, it was one of those books I read when I was at university. I wouldn't particularly say it was something that most people would find wildly exciting, but it talks about how there was a whole cultural revolution associated with the Reformation. And before the Reformation, you had a number of unusual customs, which nowadays would seem quite strange. And one of them, I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this, is that, you know, the host is in medieval Christianity, the bread and wine.
Yes.
But the host is the bread that is given to the congregation.
Yeah.
And the priest only had the wine in those days.
Yep.
I believe that may be the case in Roman Catholicism today. Is it post-Vatican II? I don't know. I'm not a Roman.
I don't know.
But in Anglicanism, we have both. But anyway, neither here nor there. But what they would do is, because it was the body of Christ, they would take it and parade it on Good Friday, and they would take it out and they would place it in a monstrance or a box and carry it out, or even a coffin. And they would dig a hole in the churchyard and they would bury it. So they were symbolically burying the body of Christ. And then on Easter Sunday at dawn, they would go and dig it up because Christ was risen and from the dead. And that kind of ceremony is something that's almost, you know, you just can't imagine anyone doing anything like that nowadays, can you?
No.
Though there are still some Easter customs we have. Don't you take part in some every year? I mean, what kind of Easter customs still persist into modern Christianity? Mystery plays. Would you like to explain mystery plays to people who are not English and might wonder what those are?
Well, yes, so you would have plays where you're talking about the life of Christ and his last days, acting that out, and you'd have people dressed as Roman soldiers, somebody carrying the cross. I believe there's one in West Cheltenham held just yesterday.
And the mystery plays, the Chester Mysteries are probably the most famous, but if you looked up the Wikipedia entry on mystery plays,
there are several cycles.
There are several cycles, and they do often, they're very obscure and very, they have kind of esoteric meanings, I'm told. Though I've never noticed, I wouldn't know what they are. Maybe they contain enigmatic wisdom. Maybe there are Creamon variants of them, which enshrine magical secrets. Maybe they are just, as they appear to be, Dominion lore. Mm. They're definitely Dominion lore, aren't they?
Yes.
So, okay, so that's something in the real world. What about mummers? What do you know about mummers? Because they were often associated with mystery plays, weren't they?
I don't know. There aren't a lot of them in the northeast. I think that's more of a southwestern thing.
Right. Well, they would dress up in costumes. I mean, another thing that was very common in the Middle Ages is misrule festivals, which gave you a chance
yes.
to get drunk and go and beg off your neighbours. And Penny for the Guy is a modern version, which is a. But that didn't exist back in the Middle Ages. But one of the version we all know nowadays is trick or treating.
Yeah.
And in fact, there would be many occasions during the year, and you could make up your own local festival because they were very specific, when the local children would come to the Covenant and beg for sweets, or where adults would turn up. And in fact, we've used that as a notion, haven't we? We had the Irish, I forgot what they're called, Sons of Brigid, who turned up in one of my adventures. Anyway, enough of this, enough of Easter.
But how to actually get this working into your first Ars Magica game, which is today's theme, Christian.
Okay, let's get back to the theme then. So
The theme.
It's like the prologue, only it's the theme. I think for your first Ars Magica game, one of the big things that most people probably think of is, why don't we have the players play apprentices? What do you think about that? Does it work?
I mean, you can do, but that involves very low-level magics, and that involves you having to look at the magic rules and be familiar with how to get the most out of very small effects.
Yeah, it involves a lot of spontaneous magic, and actually playing an apprentice is hard. And especially if you're using the apprentice's book, which is, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Slender?
It's both slender, it's the smallest of the Ars Magica 5 books, but it's also, it's not a bad book. I mean, it was written, it took a long time to write to get right, but it's got some great ideas in, but it actually involves you knowing the background. I think playing apprentices is actually really difficult to do well. So although it seems like a good place to start, actually, I think where David Chart starts in 5th edition with those template characters,
yes.
I actually quite like the example characters now. And I never looked at them for years and years and years. But there are 12, I believe, example characters.
12 example magi and a few companions and half dozen grogs.
Yeah. And I find those are actually, rather than trying to design the first characters, my inclination now would be to hand out pre-generated characters and try and understand the very basic rules. I did years ago create an article on my blog called About Ars Magica, about my hobby for people who don't play role-playing games.
Yeah.
That explains how the rules work. And when I ran a example adventure at Games Expo a few years ago, that was where I started, was with, I handed out pre-generated magi with the spells printed out. I printed out the whole spell description from the PDF. But, sorry about the annoying noises coming from the car park. I don't know if they'll play up in the background. Somebody's revving their engine and doing...
Are they spinning their wheels?
It sounds like it. I've got no idea at all. Oh, well. Anyway, they've stopped now. But, yeah, I mean, we started off with character sheets that were fairly full and just explaining enough. One thing that's really useful is to get the players to write down meanings of Creo, Rego, Perdo, you know, the actual techniques and forms. And then I tend to do a little quiz saying, right, okay, you're trying to cross a river. How would you do this? You're trying to get up a tree. What combination would you use to try and, you know... And there's no right answer, because there's multiple ways you can put together techniques and forms to do almost anything, aren't there?
Yes.
What's also useful is to have an idea of how to quickly work out spontaneous spell levels. But often, I mean, the great thing about 3rd edition and 1st and 2nd edition was you just made them up to whatever felt right.
Yeah.
The advantage of that is it was a lot quicker, because the referee just said...
Yeah.
The disadvantage of that was it was completely inconsistent across the game.
And then before you know it, you have to remember your precedence and what you've done before and gone, actually, should that be a little higher?
Yeah, last time I flew over the river, it was a Creo, it was a Rego Corpus level 10.
Yeah.
This time it's 25. What's the difference? Yeah. And, you know, I can see why. And David Chart revolutionised Ars Magica with 4th edition when he brought in a method which actually worked out for you.
Solid base guidelines for the arts.
Yeah. And that is what makes the modern game. So it went from a very light story game to a very heavy simulationist game. Would you say that was fair?
That's a fair answer.
Anyway, go on then, Tom. First adventure for a referee, what would you do? I mean, one of the things I used to say was do an adventure based on Robin Hood or something that involves grogs and companions, but actually that I totally disagree now, because I think the whole thing about Ars Magica is playing a magi.
Yeah, I mean, certainly playing with grogs and companions does let you get used to the rules more easily, gets you into the setting. So if you want to learn the rules quickly, that's probably the easiest way to get used to that, things like combat, doing the eased factors.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of getting into the magic of the game, do you want to start with the magic as fast as possible? Probably.
Another thing is that there is the Code of Hermes exists on two levels. It's an in-game artifact by which, you know, people are supposed to follow the code because they've sworn to it. But also, if you follow the Code of Hermes and use that as a meta rule, so you suggest to the players they don't break it without a good reason. And there might be good reasons, just as, you know, Captain Kirk occasionally breaks the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
But you should hesitate to break that, because that means that you don't end up with the kind of murder hobo freebooting parties
that certain other games of a long dungeon bashing tradition will have.
But it certainly is the case that very often, whenever I've run Ars Magica, the players have been disruptive to the order as a whole.
Yes.
And certainly in a campaign where you don't, where the other when the other covenants are not being played by players. I mean, now, of course, we're playing games where the other covenants are also player characters. And where they might, you might in the future actually need to ask them for help. Is there a lot of rivalry between covenants in our campaign?
There's a certain amount, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, every so often, Witchwood, Avalon talk about burning down Witchwood, don't they?
No, no, no. They just won't let it lie. We burnt their woods down the once. We reseeded them. We drew the forest. They're just still bitter about it, decades on.
Yeah, and one of your magi actually was kicked out of Witchwood, wasn't she?
Yes.
Yeah, so the player actually left that game and joined your game.
Yeah.
But it's still in the same campaign.
Yes.
And that has led to the amusing, many amusing stories over the years. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the nice thing about the new campaign, is that if you've got multiple referees running in the same setting, then players can find their way to...
But, back to advice for people running their first game. The theme.
Okay, so firstly, try and encourage the players to think of the Code of Hermes as something that is more than just a game artifact. That it's actually also a kind of guideline. Your character is a magician who is working within those rules normally. They don't go around murdering and stealing just for the fun of it. You know, they are actually... I mean, what does the code really restrict? What does the code say about the kind of adventures you should have?
Not dealing with demons. Not interfering with mundanes in a way that'll bring ruin upon you. Not molesting fairies. Not waging war on your wizards unless you've formally declared it all properly first.
Yeah, I mean, that is the point. There are, you shouldn't go around, you know, just randomly attacking people. It's a game about a group of wizards who have entered into a... Do you think... So, your first story, what should it be about? What would you go for?
Well, one idea I've had is starting with magi who are ready to go on. Let's say, take your starting mages. Remove Power Magicka 1 from the list of abilities. And say so that's their final step. Go to, you have a tribunal or maybe a ceremony of welcome where you're there, ready to become full magi. So you'll get to meet local quaestors, local magi.
Ah, so you're going to meet a bunch of NPCs. Now, yeah. If I was going to do that, I would produce a sheet with details, just a paragraph about 3 or 4 other covenants. And details about the magi who live there. And it might just be a list of names and houses and a personality trait for each. And I would share that with the players. So these are the people you meet at the tribunal. And then you've already established your setting. And by just handing it to the players on a piece of paper, they then can write to them or call upon them. And they feel like they're part of an organic community. Now, we don't need to do that in an online game with many covenants already existing.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to be playing in a setting with people who are already playing, then they'll meet the other players. But, yeah, I think that's a good plan, but it could be overwhelming.
And then, you know, you mentioned your idea about trying to ask people about how to spontaneously cast spells.
Yeah.
We'd have the senior mage go, well, so to pass your test to become a proper wizard, you just need to do a couple of magical things, answer a couple of questions. So some of them you could abstract to a die roll, things like, they ask you about the magic theory of how you should account for the planets when creating an enchantment, letting you roll a die and see, oh, so this is what you use your magic theory for. And then some things like, you know, getting them to, well, more exciting than cross a river, have one of them magically create a pit, magically create some oil to fill it, set it on fire, and say, go on, cross that.
I'm a real heretic in Ars Magica because, unlike almost everybody else, I've always favoured having one or two magi per story.
Well, probably one. At university, try to keep it down to, you know, one or two. Basically about a quarter of the party magi, everyone else grogs and companions.
Yeah, I mean, normally I'd let everybody have a grog. So everyone's got a character, but also you play either a magi or a companion. Playing two characters is not as hard as you might think, because the grogs are usually, until they take centre stage and then you switch to their viewpoint, you normally they're quietly getting on with it and drinking beer and singing songs. But I really do feel that there comes a point when you absolutely want to stop the players turning up with every magi they have. Now, how that's meant to work, and the reason why it did work originally, apparently, is because magi got better, not by going on adventures, but by staying in the lab.
So, in order to get better, it's so much easier if you could just stay at home, concentrate on reading books, because reading books you knew what XP you'd get, none of this go on adventure, risk your life, get some XP, maybe you end up with more stuff than you went out with, maybe you end up spending more V's than you actually got from the adventure, you just don't know. Yeah. Because if you stay at home in the lab, you know exactly what you're going to get, and if you want to build enchantments, suddenly you can have, oh, I've got magic items, I can do this and that. Staying in the lab meant you could reliably add more tools to your kit without having to risk yourself.
Another problem with ours, I found when I first started trying to do it, was it's a bit like superhero games. The power levels can be so immense fairly quickly that either the magi could solve the entire problem, you know, the French are invading England, okay, we'll destroy their army and make them all poo themselves, as you know, that's the kind of thing characters can do. But that level of power becomes very difficult to write if you're used to writing at a more sort of D&D level.
Yes.
So I tended to begin by offering moral dilemmas. It's a bit like Star Trek, really, because ultimately Captain Kirk could use the Enterprise
and just blast everyone into submission.
Yeah, I mean, he could just blow up the planet where the green aliens are. But he doesn't, does he? He doesn't.
He could have a scout on a hilltop, take a pair of binoculars, go, oh, this is where they are. Mr. Scott, here are the coordinates. Teleport this person straight into the brig on the ship. Congratulations, there's not a prisoner in the galaxy who can stop a spaceship with a magic teleporter from doing what it wants.
No, no, exactly. And that is part of the problem. So you have to have moral questions involved. You have to have other reasons to actually adventure. So we still haven't decided, though, what would make a great first adventure.
Anyway, so I suggested my idea of meet some NPCs to get a sense of setting. Have a few challenges where you're asked to solve it with your magic, so try and cast some spells, or what you have, or try and cast some spontaneous spells. Be asked to demonstrate your favourite spell. So maybe they set up some mannequins for you to cast your offensive spells at, or they get a grog for you to mind read. So, you know, if you're somebody who's all mentem magic, they'll go, okay, we've just whispered to a grog the name of somebody he's not supposed to tell you. Try and work it out from him. And then you try and use your mentor magics. Things like that. And then maybe pose a legal dilemma or two about the code, where basically ask, the code says, you know, I shall not molest the Fae, lest I bring ruin upon my Sedales. Outline a situation. Ask the players how they'd try and solve it, or how they'd approach it. And then we go, fantastic, you're a magi. Great. Swear the oath. Give them the printout from, you know, from the book, the little section of the code. Read out the oath. Congratulations, your apprentices are now magi and ready to join a covenant.
There is another way you can do it as well.
Please elaborate.
You could take a much more mathematical approach. Plan your saga from the beginning as follows. Take a piece of paper, draw some squares on it. Look up major virtues and flaws. Look up minor virtues and flaws, but start with the story ones and the personality ones. For a major one, grid in stories that take up, you know, 3 blocks, or at least are a whole story. So there is a whole story about the fact that Aziraphale is proud, or there is the whole story about the fact that Honorius is infernally tainted. Yeah.
Yeah.
And take the virtues and flaws that are chosen in character generation or that are on the pre-generated characters and write stories to fit them. So over the course of the saga, everybody's personality flaws and story flaws are guaranteed to feature.
That's a solid piece of planning your first saga advice. What would you recommend for the actual first story, though?
You choose one magi, just one, because mm-hmm. it'll be hard enough to get the rules to be able to follow. Let everybody have access to the rule book and show them how magic works, and then have everybody else play their companions. So you've only got to worry about one magician and send them out. And I mean, a classic adventure I like to run is it's raining. It's rained for days. The rain is beating down. The crops will soon be ruined. The thatch is starting to rot. The villagers realise that starvation is going to fall on them. The first problem you've got is, how do you stop the rain? Well, badger wood up on the hill, for some reason, it seems to be at the centre of the storm. There is an eye of the storm there. There's an area in the centre of the wood through which you can see sunlight, which is coming down on the tallest tree in the forest. So clearly, whatever is happening has a very obvious... There is a point when you go and look for it where it's geographically fixed. So, all you've got to do is set off through the pouring, miserable, persistent rain, using some spells like Cloak of Duck's Feather. What's the other one called?
Like Water Off Your Back? I can't remember. Something like that.
Yeah, Water Off a Duck's Back, something like that. But yeah, you use spells that prevent you from getting wet and cold and taking... And you trudge through the mud. And you go to Badger Wood. And Badger Wood is, as the name suggests, badgers are common there. Yeah, exactly. But there is also something quite dark and mysterious about it. And the further you go into it, the stranger it becomes, the weirder it becomes, until you find yourself dealing with the Badger King, or climbing the tallest tree in the forest to pass through the clouds to enter into the land that floats above the clouds. Is this turning into the Folk of the Faraway Tree by Enid Blyton? But, you know, it still works. It's climbing a tree in the through, you know, having come through a storm to go up and then walk out onto the land above the clouds is quite a medieval concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
Perhaps a skyship that's flying across the skies has dropped anchor there. But whatever the root cause, maybe it's the witch who lives in the middle of Badger Wood. But the players know where to go. They've got a clear objective and they've got a clear plan. They need to go and stop the rain. Their plan is to go there, stop the rain and come back. They know what they're trying to do. And that stops them being overwhelmed by choice. In role-playing games, it's often good to have a clear objective.
Yeah.
So the players know what they're aiming for. And along the way, there's loads of opportunities for, you know, role-play. And there's room... There's lots of opportunities for combat or excitement or things to occur, and they'll meet people and they'll discuss things. But also, the party will end up with different plans. They might fall out with one another. All kind of things could happen. Another possibility is if you've got a character who's a werewolf, it's always good to have someone running amok killing sheep and the characters trying to deal with that, you know. Lycanthropy always makes for good stories. Look at the story flaws, look at the dark secrets, talk to the players about it before you drop them directly in as the protagonist. But I would just go for something simple. Let the players know what they need to achieve. Give them... The great thing about Ars Magica is that because they can invent their own spells, they can create their own solutions, endless possibilities. Look at folklore, get a copy of something like the Reader's Digest Book of Amazing Stories. I forgot what it's called, Strange Tales and Amazing Stories, or the Reader's Digest Book of British Folklore. Look round for old folklore books, take a story or a fairy story, turn it into an adventure. It's not that difficult. We've run an entire campaign based on Somerset folklore, haven't we?
We have, yes.
And, you know, Ed quite often recognises the story I'm riffing off, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And in fact, quite amazingly, almost every character now has got area lore Somerset or legend lore Somerset folklore or something like that, haven't they?
Yes.
So, I don't think that that's a bad idea, but there's no right or wrong way. You do whatever works for your players, and players are very different. Some players want to explore, some players want to gain new powers, some players want to blow shit up.
Yes, and not to derail the theme completely... So you mentioned we should set up stories to deal with people's story flaws. What do you see as the most common flaws that players take, in your experience?
Ah, that's an interesting one. So,
just so we can offer advice that's useful that people might see.
Let's ask people. Let's have a poll. Ask people to write in and tell us what they think are the top 10 story flaws that you should consider taking for a new character to give you a bit of personality or to give you... Yeah? What are your favourite story flaws? So if you've got any idea on that, you could write to us on Chris Jensen. Right, actually, how you never work out how to spell that. How can people write to us easily?
I don't know. You see, do you have a web presence or a blog or anything that people can easily find?
Yeah, okay. They can go to... My email is Chris Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N-R-O-M-E-R, all one word. C-H-R-I-S-J-E-N-S-E-N-R-O-M-E-R at hotmail.com. But we'll pop it into the Ars Magica forum and we'll have a discussion about choosing your first story flaws.
Yeah. Now, some people like to take the family ones, like black sheep or close family relations.
Yep.
Some people like plagued by supernatural because it's a major one. So lots and lots of points for your min-maxer to build their character with, while also going, there's this particular type of supernatural enemy.
Yeah, actually, I've never even... Because I've designed so few characters compared with you.
Yeah. My current character's a tutelar, so I took Tormenting Master. It's a classic for that house.
And it has actually... I mean, Kronos has appeared many times.
He has appeared several times. How he keeps escaping is beyond us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone. I hope that some of this has been useful, or at least it sparked some ideas of your own. Do write to us with your favourite story flaws, or if you've got ideas for a starting adventure, do write and let us know what you think. And next time, we'll be talking about, Tom, story flaws, clearly.
Yes, because that's what you've asked about. Story flaws, good ideas for plots for them, and how to work those and other flaws into your game.
Okay, so this has been Chris and Tom, and this is Arcane Connection. Take care.
Bye.